asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're answering your listener questions.
Buddy, perhaps this is our listener's favorite day of the week. Not that this is anything at all similar to what we have with our listeners, but it makes me think about like calling your folks. It kind of makes their day. I don't know if it makes their week, but the ability to catch up, see how they're doing.
Yeah, I know.
It's almost like a phone call with our listeners to a certain extent. It's one-sided.
I appreciate it. I like hearing like what's going on in their financial lives and kind of being able to go through some of the nuances of the questions that they've got going on. I love these episodes.
Well, it adds flesh to the bones, right? Because the bones, for the most part, don't change. The principles, the values, they remain. But all the different color that goes into making each story, each individual's question unique, that's what it's all about.
That's right.
Here on Ask How to Money Monday episodes. But we've got a listener who's asking about getting a cheap cell phone. Is that even possible these days? We'll share our thoughts there. Another teacher, actually, he's wondering how it is that he can actually teach frugality as opposed to teaching cheapness. So we're going to kind of dive into that. And another listener, he's wondering if it ever makes sense to borrow money in order to invest, if that's something that he hasn't done yet. He's a little behind, wants to know if he should be doing that. So we'll get into some investing plus more on today's episode, buddy.
That's right. But before we get to that, Matt, we had Ilana from LifeWell Cruised on recently, kind of quizzing her about going on cruises because you and I Never done it before. We didn't even really know what questions to ask. We were just doing our best.
I was asking questions about seasickness because I get motion sick.
Yeah.
Wait, did we, at the beginning, I think we discussed whether or not, like by the end of it, we're going to decide whether or not we're going to go on a cruise, but we didn't ask each other that.
I think I
will.
Will
you go on a cruise?
I think I probably will someday.
Did she talk you into it?
Not really. No, okay. Like Caribbean cruises still do not sound like my jam.
Yeah.
I think at some point I will go on some sort of river cruise or maybe
the Alaskan
cruise.
Iceberg, calving kind of viewing, that kind of stuff.
If
that,
it allows
that seems
me,
a little more adventurous.
If it allows me to see things that I wouldn't otherwise be able to see from land, that's what attracts me to cruises. But if I'm just going to like different ports of call in the Caribbean, like I could go visit those other ways.
Yeah.
But okay, so here's one thing. Because we know so little, we're just doing our best. So a lot of listeners came up with some great advice after that episode, posting in the Facebook group or sending us emails, stuff
listeners
like that.
Listeners who are into cruising.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they had some great advice.
Man, so, Matt and Joel are idiots when it comes to boats.
We are. And so if you were listening and you're like, yeah, there were a bunch of great stuff that they didn't talk about, you can always post that in the How to Money Facebook group, and other people can appreciate your wisdom as well. Well, listener Greg, Matt, he reached out and he said there's actually a website similar to Google Flights for cruises. And I think we asked Ilana about that, and she didn't seem to know of anything like that. Well, Greg says
she's mostly pointing us to the specific cruise lines because they've got a lot of good information there.
That's right. So if you're kind of looking to find a deal, cruiseplum.com is what Greg recommended. I was looking at it a little bit, and I kind of it's very basic in the way that it's set up, but it offers you the ability to get like to find last minute deals, and it really categorizes these destinations and ports of call. And well, how cheap actually is it compared to what it normally costs? Cruise Plum seems to do a good job of that, so you can
shows the actual discount.
Yeah, so if you're like, no, I want the 30% off rate. Well, Cruise Plum is it looks like it's going to be able to help you find that.
Very cool. I was literally talking with a friend yesterday, and he's never been on a cruise before, and he is going because his mom wants to go on a cruise, and so they're getting the family together, and they're going to go with his mom on a cruise. I could see myself doing something like that.
Yeah.
Like there kind of needs to be another reason to go on a cruise. Although, as I think about it, the ability to hit up a bunch of different islands, like all in one trip, it's a nice like sampler platter of it's like a nice little charcuterie board of Caribbean travel.
I get why some people like it. And it doesn't sound like my thing, but you never know.
You never know.
Go on my first one,
yeah,
I might get bitten by the bug and like feel like I got to keep going on them. But
I can see that being the case, buddy.
Good to know about Cruise Plum. We'll link to that in our show notes
too for this episode. Will. Yeah, thanks to listener Greg for sending that our way. Joel, our beer that we're going to enjoy during this episode is called This Is the Day. And this is a tart saison, another one by Piedmont Brewery down there in Macon, Georgia. We'll drink, enjoy, and share our thoughts at the end of the episode.
That's right. But on to listener questions. If you have a money question you'd like Matt and I to discuss on the show, we'd love to hear from you. The simple instructions are available at howtomoney.com/ask, but really it's just recording a voice memo and sending it our way, and hopefully we can take it on the next Ask HTM episode. Matt, let's get to this first one. This one is about asset allocation.
Hi, Matt and Joel. It's Yessel from New York City. Your advice has gotten me through lots of personal finance milestones, so thank you for everything you do. And here are some additional questions. So back in 2020, I opened a SEP IRA through M1 Financed, and I used a template pie based on a podcast that I'd listened to, and it was based on David Swensen's portfolio. And I haven't touched any of the slices since, and more or less they break down into Vanguard Total Stock 30%, VNQ Vanguard Real Estate ETF 20%, VXUS Vanguard Total International Stock 20%, VGIT Vanguard Intermediate Term Treasury Index ETF 15%, and TIP iShares Bond ETF 15%. So my questions are as follows. First, should I be changing these up to go more in the directions of the ETFs you've recommended on your pod and your investment blogs? Are there any red flags in terms of what I'm investing in currently? And then second, I want to open another IRA because I have a pretty hefty chunk of saved in a Bank of America savings account. Obviously, I'd rather have money work for me rather than just sit in savings with very little interest. So do you recommend I open another IRA, whether it's traditional Roth, within M1, since I already have an account with them, or should I open one in Vanguard or some other company separately? Thanks so much.
All right. Yeah, so let's just go ahead and start at the top. And first of all, we're glad to hear that you've got a SEP IRA. That's a killer account for self-employed folks.
Oh, yeah.
Although I will say, if there's our listeners out there and you own your own business and you're thinking about starting an employer-sponsored retirement account, we're a little more partial to the solo 401k or the self-employed 401k.
Which are the same thing, just two different names.
Two different names that some of the different brokerages go by. So we're not going to... And it mostly has to do with how it is that you can contribute. You can actually contribute a little bit more because you're able to contribute as an employee, not just as an employer.
Yeah, you get to wear both hats.
Exactly. We're not going to get bogged down into the details, though. But we can link to, we had a conversation with Sean Mullaney, who is a tax professional. He's a CPA, and he specializes in tax for the FIRE community, the financial independence, retiring early.
Literally wrote the book on solo 401ks.
Yes, and he kind of breaks down why he's such a fan, so we'll link to that episode in our show notes. But the first part of your question, though, it's highly specific on fund allocation. And I'll say, here on the show, we try to offer broad-based advice. We try not to get too terribly specific, and that is for a few reasons. One, for most folks, it's all about savings rate. It's all about simplicity. Basically, the more that you are able to save and the simpler your methodology, the easier it is to stay the course. And I'll say expense ratios as well. The more affordable you keep it, the more of your money that you get to keep that compounds over the years. But secondly, every financial situation is going to be different. If we're talking about specific asset allocation here, we'd have to factor in your your current age or your current savings level, when it is that you want to retire, your likely lifespan, some of the different goals that you have for your life, individual risk tolerance, right? Like there are so many other things to address as to whether or not your current allocation is ideal. So it is a little tricky to dive into the particulars and to say yes or no, red flags or no red flags regarding your specific portfolio.
Yeah, that's why we typically break it down into wealth building and wealth preservation, the two kind of distinct segments of your life. And for some people, you're very much firmly in the camp of the wealth building phase of your life. You're in your 20s, 30s, 40s, and you're like, I'm not retiring.
We think, based on how old you sound.
Yeah. Yessel sounds like she's probably in that camp. But then there are other listeners who are in the wealth preservation side of things.
Sound old.
even like the older Gen Xers who are saying, listen, I'm getting closer to retirement.
Sure.
I can't take as much risk as the wealth building crowd, the folks who are invested and feel comfortable being invested almost solely in stocks. And so, yeah, your pie specifically, Yessel, It sounds like something that would be traditionally recommended, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned David Swensen. He was a smart dude. He managed Yale's endowment fund incredibly well over the years. But then there are different goals for something like an endowment fund than maybe your own personal goals. You're not looking to achieve the same things. And so it's kind of like how people compare hedge fund returns to how the S&P 500 did in a given year. Well, if hedge funds underperform, people like to point and laugh and be like, ha ha, look at that. there you go. Broad-based market exposure for the win. But the truth is, the stated goal of most hedge funds isn't to beat average market returns. They often care more about risk minimization, and they're willing to accept reduced returns in a given year to accomplish that, which means that in a down year, oftentimes hedge funds are not down nearly as much as the overall market, and that is one of the bigger goals for a lot of folks who choose to invest in those funds. And so I would just say be careful who you're copying, because their goals might not be the same as your goals.
That's true, yeah. Yeah, it depends, again, what your risk tolerance is. It depends on when you're going to need the money, and you are well-diversified. And so there's no red flags going up there where it sounds like you're too all-in on one thing over another. But it's possible that you are maybe too diversified and that you are invested maybe a little conservatively. And this is especially true if you don't need the money for decades to come. Yeah. Again, if you are in that wealth building stage of your life, mm-hmm. and your allocation reflects something closer to a target date fund, given the bond and treasuries exposure that you have in there. But honestly, even like a little more conservative than a target date fund. But the good news is that if you do decide to change things up, to switch things up to be a little more stock heavy, well, doing that inside of a tax advantaged account, well, what's great here is that it's not going to result in any sort of tax bill. But again, this is a personal decision with a whole lot of different inputs. And so, well, basically, we'll just leave it there. And we've shared on the show before how, I mean, I'm 41 years old. I am 100% invested in the S&P 500. Not even equities, but like the S&P.
Hey, you don't look a day over 40, buddy.
Well, thank you. But even still, like, I shouldn't even say my age, because it doesn't matter how old I am. It depends on when I need access to those funds.
Because if you were like a fire adherent and you're going to retire at 43,
you're
in the wealth preservation stage now.
Exactly. Yeah. And so it's worth asking yourself a bunch of questions too, as to like, how did you, like, you sound like a very level-headed person. And so did you freak out when the market tanked in 2022 when it basically was down like 20%, I think? Yeah. If no is the answer there, well, then you might be a good candidate for switching up to a portfolio allocation that is a little more aggressive, because you are on top of things. You're not investing emotionally. You're not being swayed by the headlines. You're not checking your balance every week, every month, seeing that number decrease and freaking out.
But then again, if it gave you heart palpitations, then you might want this more conservative portfolio so that it allows you to kind of stay invested through thick and through thin.
Yep.
And Matt, I love what you said too. You're right. Inside of those tax advantaged accounts, there's no tax consequences for selling and buying. And so that wouldn't be true though in a taxable brokerage account, where if you're like, ooh, I want to rebalance a little bit, you're oftentimes going to face tax consequences for doing so.
Mm-hmm.
And all right, next, Yessel, she mentioned banking with Bank of America. They're not the devil, but...
Oh,
My goodness, you need a new bank, Yessel. Like, please.
You're very close to the devil.
I don't want to dwell on this, and we'll link to an article about switching banks in the show notes, but just make sure that you're not staying with one of the big banks who pays almost nothing and doesn't care about you. should you be investing more of the cash that's sitting on the sidelines, though? That also depends on a number of factors, like how reliable is your income? How many months' worth of expenses do you currently have on hand? And also, do you have any major medium-term money goals? Typically, that means, oh, I'm going to replace the car and I'm going to try to pay cash for it, or I got to have this down payment on hand to buy a home. You know, if some of that money is being saved for a down payment and you're planning to buy in the next year or two, keep it in savings. But if you've got 15 months of expenses on hand and your job is pretty solid, I'd feel more than okay at getting some of that money out of the bank and investing more of those dollars. But again, what's the money for? When do you need it? What's the timeline? Those are all really important questions. But more than anything, yeah, get your money out of a bank that's paying you next to nothing on the substantial savings that you have.
Heck yeah. And you mentioned investing within a Roth IRA. I think that would be a good choice. And what's great here too is it sounds like you've got a decent amount of money set aside in within your savings account. And were you to go ahead and open that additional Roth IRA, like, so A, well, the good news here is that you can invest in, you can put that money towards your Roth IRA last year, so $6,500, and you can also fund this year's Roth IRA, so $7,000. So, and I'm not trying to downplay how much money this is, but we're only talking about $13,500, which that is a big chunk of money.
That would be most people's savings.
But when you have potentially, you know, months, maybe even years of living expenses set aside, you have the ability to max out your tax advantage retirement accounts in this way without even putting up that big of a dent in the amount of savings that you have on hand. So what I'm pointing to is the fact that you still have the ability to chase after some of those large, some of those medium-term financial goals that you might have. Let's say you want to put $150,000 towards a house because you're gonna buy a big, nice house. Well, you still have the ability to do that while also fully taking advantage of all tax advantage retirement accounts that are available to you.
And the SEP's a great account, but you know, putting money in the Roth as well, because that's just one of our favorites and it's treated differently from a tax perspective, it's going to give you some of that differential tax treatment, which can be helpful later on down the road.
Exactly. Yeah. And you can, like she mentioned, she's been investing with M1. They do a great job. M1 is it's geared a little more towards folks looking, I think, for diversity within their investing. They've got those different pies set up. It's a little more, I think, for like kind of traditional investors, maybe like serious investors, folks who aren't just dabbling and potentially day trading single stocks, which is... It tends to be what Robinhood is kind of geared for. But that being said, guess who has the match? And we've talked about Robinhood plenty here on the show. But if you are looking, especially considering that, okay, so Yesil, she's got a SEP IRA. That means she's a business owner. You can't be a business owner without being very organized and level-headed. And so in my mind, she could be an incredible candidate for opening a Roth IRA with Robinhood, because I don't see her going in there and making a knee-jerk reaction because of the headlines, because of something that someone posted within Wall Street Bets on Reddit, that kind of thing. And so the ability to get that match, I think, is pretty huge if you can invest in a way that aligns with how you've been investing.
If you can no touchy.
No touchy, then I'm totally for it.
But that's easier said than done sometimes when you're dealing with a platform like that.
Yeah, but that being said, over time, my view has slightly changed when it comes to Robinhood because of the match and just because of how we talk about credit cards. I think that if you have the discipline and the wherewithal, basically, to handle credit cards responsibly and use them in a way to maximize points and cash back, I think the same thing can be true of how it is that you interact with Robinhood.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of person in my mind, which is basically me. Like, I'm thinking about myself because I know that I'm like, yeah, like I never freaking carry a balance on my credit cards. I always am maxing out the points and cash back that I'm getting through there. So why would I not also do that with Robinhood, we've recently discussed?
No, I get that. I get that argument. I guess there's just ways.
You got to be careful. You got to know yourself.
So many things trying to break our brains these days, including social media, and it's hard to resist, right? There are different things out there that we can at least mentally tell ourselves, oh, I'm going to avoid that pitfall. But then when it comes to actually avoiding it and not doom scrolling for 20 minutes before bed, a lot of people still end up doing that. So you just have to know yourself and you have to be really careful. So yes, M1 is a good option. Robinhood can be a decent option if you want the match. And Vanguard, Fidelity, Schwab are also great choices too. I mean, there are a bunch of different investment houses that prioritize low cost, low fees, and make it easy. So having your accounts all in one place can be kind of nice as well. So
yeah.
I don't know if you like the interface and features of M1. You keep all your business there, right? And M1 does a really good job, and they offer a lot of the low-cost funds. They can make it incredibly cheap for you to invest, which is huge. More of your money working for you.
That's right.
But Yesil, thank you again for that question. When it comes to asset allocation, so much of it comes down to a lot of personal factors. Hopefully, we gave you a lot of good information without giving you specific, pinpointed investing advice.
Sure,
Matt, we've got more money questions to get to on this episode. We're just talking about investing. What about borrowing money to invest because you feel like you're behind the eight ball. We'll get to that and more right after this. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
And now a word from the show sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
All right, buddy, we are back from the break. And now let's hear from a listener who's doing a little bit of lesson planning and he wants our take.
Hey, Joel and Matt. My name's Mr. G, and I'm a teacher from Pennsylvania. I've been teaching for a while, but am teaching personal finance for the first time ever, which has been very cool and very exciting. I have an idea for a lesson that I think I could maybe use your help with. In the spring, we'll be covering budgeting, and I think within budgeting, it'd be important to stress the idea of being frugal within certain categories of your budget. However, I want the kids to know, what's the difference between being frugal and being cheap? You guys talk about this all the time, and I thought I could maybe get your help in explaining the difference between the two to the students. What does it mean to be frugal? How's that different than being cheap? Why is one maybe a good thing and the other not so much? And when you're making decisions, what do you consider when deciding if something is frugal or cheap? Could you maybe talk us through the considerations that you guys go through in this thought process? Maybe give us an example that some high school students could relate to? And in the end, something that I'm hoping maybe all of us could benefit from in examining our own personal budgets. Any help in this would be greatly appreciated. I plan on using your intro as a way to show the difference between frugal and cheap, and then having the students work through a bunch of sample or fictional scenarios that will connect to their lives and the age that they're at right now. And are the people in those scenarios being frugal, or are they being cheap? And why is it important to know the difference? Joel and Matt, thank you for everything you do. I appreciate it, and I very much appreciate your help with this assignment.
Joel, are you about to get a did not complete assignment for Mr. G?
Listen,
did you do your homework?
Mr. G, I'm happy to do your job for you here, okay? No, I love that you're getting into teaching personal finance, and clearly we need teachers who care about the subject and want their students to learn. I'm really enthusiastic about the increase in the amount of states that are dedicating and they're creating laws essentially to make financial literacy a required course in high schools throughout the country. I think we got roughly half the states down, Matt, half the states to go. Next Gen Personal Finance and our friend Yanelli, who was on the show not too long ago, have done just incredible work on that front. But then at the same time, yeah, we need the requirement, but we need the teachers who care a great deal. Mr. G sounds like one of those guys. My favorite teacher in high school, by the way, was Mr. D.
There you go.
Yeah.
Mr. G, Mr. D. Yeah, because it's about, I like what he said about
but connecting it. But he didn't teach me anything about money.
About connecting it to their lives, because that is, I think, where money shines. Like, there is an inherent advantage that personal finance and money has, because, like, what kid doesn't want to have more money?
Yeah.
Not necessarily just to, like, walk around loaded and, you know, or however much money in their wallet or
pulling fat stacks,
or however much money in their Cash App account or whatever, but to tie the money that they have with what they're able to do with that money, whether buy it or the opportunities that is going to afford them. I feel like there is an inherent advantage to money, and man, being able to connect those dots like that is huge. And that's what being a great teacher is, because even though it's inherently an interesting topic, money or personal finance, you can still approach it in a way that is dry, disinteresting, to the point to where kids are completely turned off by it. Unfortunately, I think that's the case with a lot of folks when it comes to how it is that they talk about money at home, because it's not something that's maybe actively discussed or encouraged.
Well, we've all been there where we've like had our favorite class, our favorite subject matter in school, but guess what? Maybe the teacher wasn't so great, wasn't as passionate. And then I've gone to like science, Matt, was my least favorite, but I had like the best physics teacher, and so I liked physics a whole lot more than I would have otherwise.
Nice.
And so it's amazing how much a great teacher who cares a whole lot can make a subject appealing where the kids might have otherwise been left a little bit bored.
Yeah, it makes me think of Professor Benz. Wasn't that the history of magic professor in Harry Potter versus Professor Lupin, right? Like, it's interactive. It's something that you can apply to your... Let's make it practical. That's what it's all about here.
That's why those, like, science experiments where you drop the eggs from the roof and stuff. Like,
it's fun. That's what you remember.
That's right. All right, let's talk about frugal versus cheap. And, well, what's the difference? I think frugality is valuing every dollar that comes into your life highly, right? You realize the impact that saving or investing that dollar can have for your future and oftentimes for your near-term future. And so when it comes to spending, you're careful about how many dollars you're willing to part with, and you're being thoughtful about what you're spending them on, right? So a frugal person, I would say, is vigilant. And Matt, you and I, we distinguish cheap from frugal, because being cheap, it often means that you're doing something to save money that's at the expense of someone else. Going out to eat, leaving a meager tip is a prime example of being cheap, not frugal. But it can be something else, even on terms of spending. I've talked about this before too, like buying the cheapest pair of jeans and then being like, oh, yeah, I don't really like those. I'm not really going to wear them.
Mm-hmm.
It was a waste of money, and it would have been worth it to save up longer, buy the nicer pair, that you're, especially when you wear them day in and day out, that you're going to actually wear for years to come. Another thing, you made fun of me for this. Getting the off-brand Doritos at Aldi's.
Oh, they suck.
Dude, so many people gave me crap for that. And I've come to realize the error of my ways. I think I hadn't had real Doritos in forever. And then when I had real Doritos, I was like, wait, these are way better. And so I rarely eat Doritos. But if I'm going to, I'm going to get real Doritos.
You're going to get the name brand.
Even though they're like three times as expensive.
Oh, no, I'm thinking of Cheetos. Cheetos has the tiger guy. Yeah. Doritos, they don't really have a mascot. They just have like the electricity triangle looking thing.
That's right,
That's part of the rebrand. Yeah, in my mind, a great framework to think about frugality versus cheapness is time. And I think when you are cheap, you are overly focused on the short term. Like, you're focused on immediacy, and you're not looking beyond the end of the day or even next week, or certainly not years to come.
And you're often willing to waste your own time in order to save a buck, not realizing how valuable your time
is. Yeah, yeah. So it's taking a broader view of the larger picture. And so when it comes, like you're talking about jeans, obviously, if you were to get the cheapest pair, they might rip, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you zoom out basically and it's just like, oh, well, if I am trying to be frugal, I'm going to get a higher quality pair of pants that might cost me a heck of a lot more, but man, these things are going to last me a really long time. I'm going to garner a whole lot more happiness, essentially, out of being able to wear these things. And you're talking about food, which also makes me think of just like fast food, right? Or like even snack food, which one of the things you're sacrificing there, and yes, it might be affordable, but you're sacrificing like nutrition value, right? Because it's just like, Well, it's there, it's convenient, I don't have to work, you know, I can just open the bag and eat the food. but if you do that day in and day out, man, what are you sacrificing there? You're sacrificing your long-term health as opposed to, let's say,
your taste buds too.
Yeah. As opposed to, let's say, buying like some grass-fed beef, getting some locally grown organic veggies, taking that home, taking the time to properly cook that thing.
Although the Costco hot dog is still allowable every once in a while.
But I think that's just a good way, regardless of the application of thinking about frugality and cheapness, is time. Yeah. Like, are you thinking about the immediacy and that you want something in the here and now, or are you thinking about something over the long haul? And you even mentioned relationships, right? Like where you are imposing your cheapness on somebody else.
I was just about to say something about that.
Yeah. Well, I think like, or I guess you mentioned it from the standpoint of like tipping a server or a barista or something like that. I think even when it comes to how it is that we spend money, or like either on people or around other people, I think it can still be helpful to look at it through the framework of time, because yes, in the near term, in like today or maybe for this month's budget, I'm saving money because we're not spending money going out to eat. We're going to just go ahead and nix those date nights, babe. I'm sorry. It's no longer important. But what are we sacrificing?
She would murder you.
we're sacrificing the ability for us to connect, just the two of us as adults, which is a more long-term goal of ours. And so I think that can be a really helpful lens in which to view cheapness and frugality.
I think the cheap person too oftentimes like looks down their nose at someone who's spending money in a way that they don't value, and that can harm your relationships too.
It's like, so judgmental.
It's like allowing the people in your life to, within reason, and that's why you have to come up with rules, I think, for this. But like, how much money are we allowed to spend each month so that we can buy the stuff we want to buy, no questions asked? And so I think having that line item and just not judging your significant other, not judging your friends for how they spend money, because everyone values things differently. We talk about this all the time. Like, people think that the amount of money that we spend on craft beer is ridiculous. Some people think that. And some people don't drink at all. And save a lot of money.
I'm starting to spend a dumb amount of money on coffee these days, which is not something I would have done before. Like before, what was I buying? I was buying the $4 bag of single origin organic from Aldi, which is a pretty good cup of coffee. But I've kind of started exploring some of the nicer stuff. And here's the thing.
You have gone into the deep end, my friend.
Maybe. I'm curious to see actually if I actually come out of the deep end. Or like once you go in, like it's tough to put the toothpaste back in the tube.
That's right.
Is it that kind of thing?
I think so.
But I guess what I'm getting at here is that it is okay to not prioritize certain expenses in your life just out of plain necessity, right? Like there might be somebody who's thinking, well, yeah, great guys, I don't have the ability to quote unquote be frugal and buy something that's a little more quality. I'm looking to just get food on the table, and this is how I'm able to do that. I totally get that, right? And so beyond the ability to proactively make some of those decisions, though, I think there are periods of time when, okay, like for the time being, I'm going to go with a cheaper option, knowing that eventually, someday, it'd be nice to go with like maybe the higher quality, more frugal option. Like with his students, it makes me think of like, what would be the absolute cheapest car to buy? I'm thinking like a 20-year-old Dodge Neon or something like that. I'm just picking on Dodge Neon.
I mean, cars have gotten more expensive, but you can probably still get one of those for like $1,600.
I'm guessing for really stinking cheap, but how long are you going to be able to continue driving that car? Yeah. Like, what's the maintenance on that thing going to be? What's the gas mileage like? As opposed to buying, let's say, a 5 to 7 year old Toyota or Honda, it's going to be a whole lot more expensive. But think about the larger cost at hand, as opposed to what you would just be spending here in the near term.
Yeah, expanding your thoughts on how much you're going to pay for something over a longer period of time versus like, is this going to meet my needs for the next 3 months? Like that's not a great way to purchase a car.
Yeah.
But okay, I think,
although sometimes it is necessary to kind of like bridge you to that next stage.
Sometimes in order to make sure you're paying cash or whatever, avoiding debt, that might be the stepping stone, but that's ultimately not a long-term solution.
Yeah, there's always trade-offs.
Yeah, all right. So we try to discuss balance regularly on the show. And the truth is there's a lot of deprivation mentality in the personal finance space. And too much of that approach often leads to extreme imbalance that's hard to keep up over the years. And Matt, we are all about sustainability. It makes me think of like working out. This is so true. Everything that comes out now is all about sustainable workout routines that you can continue to do for years on end, as opposed to, and same with the diet, right? Both of those things. What can you continue over the long haul. And the same is true when it comes to your personal finance goals. Like, it's crucial to identify a few spending categories in your life where you happily spend money. That's what the craft beer equivalent is all about. You can't afford everything, but calling out those spending areas that move the needle for you and proactively allocating dollars towards those is really important. And I think that is going to help you be frugal, saying, listen, it's not in those categories, so I don't mind dialing back significantly on my spending in these other areas. This is why it's like, who cares about what cell phone service you have, as long as it makes the calls and the texts and allows you to, you know, check your fantasy football team or whatever it is, but it's saving you money every single month. I mean, there are all sorts of things like that we talk about on The Fringe to save money. And it's not because we're cheap. It's because
we don't care
much about more expensive service doesn't give you much more.
Yes, exactly. It's a value call. And I think especially, too, when you're talking to students, I mean, even adults don't exactly know what it is that lights them up and the things that they want to spend more money on. And so I think especially as students, you might think you know. But even still, I would encourage younger folks to be careful about the money that they're spending in certain areas. And almost to, like,
those might morph and change over the years. Yeah, they inevitably will morph
and change. But also just initially, while you're still experimenting and trying to figure out what it is that interests you, don't overcommit to one specific area. Try a bunch of different things as you're trying to figure out, oh, who am I becoming? Who am I growing into? In which direction are my interests being cultivated? And I think that can keep you from overspending in certain areas where you might end up having some regrets. Yeah. I think that's important to keep in mind as well.
I think as long as you're always saving and investing some and you're growing that amount, growing the portion of the pie that's dedicated to those things over the years, then you're in a good spot. As long as you're not spending more than what you make, that's a massive part of it too, right?
Totally.
All right. Mr. G.
Nice little deep dive on frugality and cheapness.
Yeah, we hope that helps you in your lesson planning and that conversation with your students. Very curious to hear how that goes. Please do let us know. Matt, let's talk about next. Let's get to a question about borrowing money in order to grow your wealth.
Hey guys, Barry from Ireland here. I have a question about borrowing for investing. I'm 36 and have no investment so far, except for some savings for a mortgage. I have a small credit card balance, maybe about 1,000. I'm about to apply for a mortgage in the next few months. Since I have no investment so far and all my money will be going towards the house saving, would it be wise to try and catch up on investing by getting a loan to start me off? Let's say instead of getting a new car or something for a couple of years, I put the money into repaying the investment loan. I was also thinking of using a robo-investor like Wealthsimple to make it easier, because I've no real idea of how to invest. Let's say I repay at 5% and forecast an 8% return. Would it be worth the risk? All right, thanks for the podcast.
All right, Barry, congrats on saving up enough to buy a house or to hopefully buy a house soon.
I wonder where in Ireland he lives, by the way.
Like Killarney, Dublin, perhaps?
Maybe.
Maybe over there on the west.
Dingle?
West coast. Oh, yeah. So,
what a great country.
We know a few Irish towns because we went on a trip there like a decade ago with our wives.
It's probably been longer than that.
Yeah.
11 or 12 years.
Yeah. But Barry, I'm not sure what the housing market and what stats look like in Ireland, but at least in the U.S., the average American, they actually have more of their wealth tied up in their home than they do in the stock market, in investments. And this isn't actually ideal, in our opinion, but it is a forced method of savings for many folks. And as the value of their home goes up and the payment stays roughly the same, aside from maybe property taxes going up, it provides a historically tried and true route to building wealth slowly. And so I want to point this out, because you say that you haven't been investing yet, and technically you haven't, because you just have cash on hand for that down payment. But you are so close to actually investing, because once you find a home, purchase that home, that down payment, that's going to immediately get transferred. It's going to
into equity.
Yeah, it's going to turn into home equity, basically. And so much of that initial net worth that you're building is going to be within that. It's not necessarily going to be because you've had that money invested and it's compounding and growing, but it's truly like a one-for-one exchange because of the money that you've saved and set aside.
But
so you're so close, and it seems like that you're behind when it comes to investing, but you're closer than you think.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing is too, Matt, buying a home, not as good of an investment over the years as investing in the market. We've talked about that. We've got articles up on howtomoney.com specifically about that and why investing in the market is superior to buying a single family home that you live in. Granted, that's providing a roof over your head, but it's not as good of an investment as people typically think. By the way, Barry, you mentioned you had a credit card balance. Please get rid of that. I know it's small, but that's even more reason to eradicate it and eradicate it quickly. I think being comfortable with credit card debt is something, it's something a lot of people have gotten used to, whether it's just keeping $2,000, $3,000, $5,000 around in credit card debt, but it's not worth it ever to have that around. And if you can't, and if you can't use credit cards without going into debt, we'd just rather have you not use them at all.
Yep.
And Matt, onto the home thing. Like, homes typically go up in value at a slower rate than the overall US or world economy, right? The reason we say that a home isn't necessarily a great investment is because of that very reason, although it can be a totally reasonable purchase. I guess like you said, invest. I want to clarify, buying a home can be a smart move, a smart buy, even if it's not some sort of like incredible investment that's going to generate massive returns. And one of the reasons I think that your home can feel like a much better investment than it is because of the reality of leverage, right? Oftentimes people are putting 5 or 10% down, though we prefer 20%, and because of that, you're able to see outsized returns. You're not necessarily paying $500K cash to buy the home. And so, but that also means that you're taking on more risk. So for example, if you put down $50K on a $500K home and that home goes up in value by $50K over the next 2 years, the return you see is much, much higher than the actual rate of return if you had bought that in cash. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah.
So the leverage is working to your advantage because you've doubled your investment essentially in just a couple years' time. But if you paid cash for that same house, the return doesn't feel nearly as significant.
Your cash on cash wouldn't have been nearly as much. Yeah, so leverage can help you to juice your returns in this way. It can make you look pretty smart. But it also, leverage and mortgaging a home, it can cut both ways. And so let's stick with that same example, Joel, and see what happens if the housing market were to experience a lull. So you put $50,000 down on that $500,000 home, hoping to maybe turn a profit, sell it in a couple years. But the house actually experienced experiences a slight pullback in price, and so you've lost money. Well, the housing market, it's been on fire, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's going to continue to soar like it has over the past decade or so. We could actually hit a plateau. We could see a minor correction. And so using leverage as a way to juice your returns where you're banking on it being effective in order to work out is a little too risky in our book. In effect, it's what you're doing. We're kind of speaking out of both sides of our mouth here because effectively it's what you are doing when it comes to investing in real estate, but that's a very different proposition than like what you're saying, which is borrowing in order to invest in the market, because you've got an actual home.
Yeah.
Like, this is a something that is tangible.
Well, that's also where your timeline matters so much, because if you're using leverage in hopes of making a quick buck, like a lot of people were doing, Matt, specifically in the Great Recession, right before the Great Recession, it's like, oh, numbers going up, let me buy this house and flip it because I'm going to make money. And if your timeline is super short, the chances that the market can bite you just increase significantly. And that's the same thing in the stock market too, right? And so at least with the house, like we've said, you're getting a roof over your head in exchange for that mortgage payment. And we always recommend a long holding period when you're buying that home. Something like 7 to 10 years dulls the potential impact of using leverage to make that purchase. But what if you're using leverage to buy stocks? Well, it is actually possible. There are leveraged ETFs that track popular indexes like the S&P 500. And so when the market is going up, you look like a genius. It's just adding to your returns. And so let's say you invest in something like a 3x leveraged S&P 500 fund. The market climbs like it did in 2023. You're Albert Einstein, right? You've made out like a bandit, but that is just not always how the cookie crumbles.
Yeah.
And so like we said, leverage is a double-edged sword.
It cuts both ways. Yeah, it doesn't come without real risk. So our friend Nick from Of Dollars and Data, he wrote about this and how bad it can be. And so for instance, this is a quote. During the coronavirus crash in 2020, a 3x leveraged ETF of the S&P 500 declined by 77% in total.
Gosh.
Compared to only a 33% decline for the actual underlying index.
33% is tough enough to stomach.
Could you imagine 3x that, dude? 77%? Like, that kind of drawdown feels like an intense gut punch. And so can you mentally stomach those kinds of losses? And history finds that even those leveraged funds don't always outperform over the long haul. They do most of the time. But even in different 20-year stretches, they fail to outperform the basic S&P 500 index fund. And so this is an instance where we would say, sure, you could expose yourself to much more risk, but we would not recommend it. I also hate these leveraged funds too, because it kind of packages all this risk in a very easy to purchase method.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I think what Barry's kind of getting at is just maybe a more traditional form of borrowing money and then just sticking that money within the stock market. But at least there's like multiple steps you have to go through, right? Like there's multiple points of getting discouraged and being like, you know, maybe I shouldn't be doing this, as opposed to just boom, all of a sudden buying a leveraged ETF.
Yeah.
But to get to the core of that, if that's his, I guess at the bottom of his question, we would say no, you don't need to be borrowing money in order to invest. And even in the example that he gave, it's a relatively small spread. I think he said like borrowing at 5% if you're expecting an 8% return. And fact is, you can't borrow money at 5, like you can't get a personal loan for 5%. It's no. Like
where are you going to get 5% money these days?
15, maybe 20% depending on your credit score.
What's going on in Ireland, Barry?
But then on top of that, the 8% return is not guaranteed. And so you're looking at an incredibly small spread.
We talked about that recently. Projected returns are from a lot of places, a lot of really smart folks are supposed to be down compared to the historical average.
Exactly. Yeah. So much of it, again, comes down to the initially here at the very beginning, most of your investments are going to be money that you set aside. And so I wouldn't get myself tied up into knots thinking, man, I've heard about this thing called compounding interest. I have not had it working in my advantage. But that doesn't mean that you need to take some more drastic steps in order to be a part of that game.
Yeah. I guess we also, though, Matt, we want to say that debt isn't always bad. And there are certain things where there are certain good kinds of debt that can actually help you in your wealth building endeavors. And so let's say someone literally is willing to lend Barry money at 3.5% or something like that, and he's guaranteed 5% returns in a high yield savings account. I take that deal all day, every day, because then you can always,
if it's guaranteed on both ends,
as long as you're not spending it, you can always take that money and pay off the debt at a moment's notice if the rates on those savings accounts plummet. So these are difficult questions to wade through, Barry, but we hope that this has been helpful. Just because you're late to the game, by the way, it doesn't mean that you need to take a different wealth building route. We want you to A, get started, and B, stay focused. And that means doing the right thing week after week, month after month. And basically, that means continuing to increase the overall amount you're investing every single year, upping that percentage that's going into your investment accounts regularly every 6 months or every year on the dot. And you mentioned robo-advisors. Wealthsimple in particular, that's a good one. Betterment is another. There are perks to going with those versus going the complete DIY route, especially if you feel intimidated by the investing process altogether. We're totally fine with that decision, but I wouldn't necessarily dial up your risk tolerance massively. I would just start small, start doing it regularly, and build over time.
Yeah. And I will say, too, some of the advantages that come with some of those different platforms have to do, you gain some of those benefits more with brokerage accounts, with the ability to tax loss harvest and the like. And so oftentimes, and here's this is where there's a disconnect, too, because we don't know what kind of investing options are available over there in Ireland. But as we're speaking to U.S. listeners, sort of going back to the first question of this episode, if you don't already have a Roth IRA set up where you're investing in an index fund, that's all you need to do. It's not any more complicated beyond that. And so make sure you're doing that first before you start paying even a 0.5% fee to some of these platforms that provide a great service, but they might be services that you don't necessarily need at this point within your investing journey.
And I wouldn't obsess over specific funds, how you're allocated.
Exactly.
I would keep it very, very simple. And the biggest thing is savings rate and getting money into those accounts. Makes it for somebody internationally too. Something like VT, like we've talked about as well, Vanguard's total world stock market index for somebody in the wealth building phase of their life. That gives you broad exposure to companies worldwide who are building great things. So
that's right. All right, man, we got you, me.
You go for it.
We're going to talk about cheap cell phones. Ooh. We'll get to that right after this.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
Spring cleaning is kind of an annual rite of passage. We've all got to do it, minimize the junk that we have in our house. Emily and I, we just cleaned our closets out. It took hours, but it was so worth it. Now we've only got stuff in there that we love, and it's easier to find everything too. And so, you know, while cleaning your closets is helpful, well, there's something else you can do for your family this spring. Shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius, for example, is a really important part of your financial planning for the year.
That's right. Yeah. And here is the thing that's important to remember, because you might be thinking you don't need to check out Policy Genius because you've got a policy through work. But even if you have a life insurance policy through your job, it may not offer you enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies, and that means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
Save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to PolicyGenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's PolicyGenius.com. All right, we're back from the break. We got more to get to, and Matt, you said we're going to talk cheap cell phones. Not cheap cell phone service. We talk about that fairly regularly here on the show.
Or maybe I should have set it up with frugal cell phones.
Frugal cell phones, yeah.
Kind of going back to Mr. G's.
That's right.
Question.
So, okay, but this question comes from our Facebook group, the How to Money Facebook group. If you're not in the How to Money Facebook group, please do go join it. If you are on Facebook regularly, let's be honest, social media, most of the time, not helpful. The How to Money Facebook group actually is. This question comes from Matthew. He says, what is the best cell phone you can get that is reasonably priced, but not something that will break in 1 or 2 years? I bought a Google Pixel 6a a year and a half ago, and I'm already having problems with the charging port. He says the charger won't stay in. It's like this with any charger. He says, I'm told by Google and a phone repair place that it would take over $350 to fix this. I'm better off buying a new phone at this point.
Isn't this exactly what you dealt with yours, the charges? So it seems like this is a recurring issue, which is kind of unfortunate to hear.
Yeah,
but
you would think at some point Google would step up to the plate and fix it, since it seems to be something widespread.
Exactly. Yeah. So I will say some of the responses on Facebook about this were incredibly helpful about repairing the charging port. And apparently things can get stuck in there, and something as simple as a toothpick can often help get lint or whatever else has gotten jammed in there to prevent charging out of there. So it's at least worth trying that, maybe blowing in it like we used to do with our Nintendo cartridges back in the day. But the other thing is, taking it somewhere in order for it to get fixed can be prohibitively expensive. So for instance, I would not pay $350 to fix a $350 phone. it's madness.
That does not compute.
But
even if you want to keep it out of the landfill, that's a stupid money move.
Yeah, but you can use some of the different sites like iFixit. We've talked about that before, but you can kind of take a more DIY approach where you can fix it yourself for
you
a whole lot less.
Your own screen?
I've replaced multiple screens.
Okay.
And
how much has it saved you?
I don't know, because I mean, the prices to get it officially repaired were so expensive, and you can buy some of the different kits. Maybe it's like $50 or something like that. They're really affordable.
But taking it to the screen repair shop's usually $150 plus.
Easy. And especially with the iPhones, when you're talking about the nicer glass, this is with like the older Gorilla Glass, but now they've got the ceramic shield glass, which is like this, supposed to be like 3X, 4X, four times harder than Gorilla Glass, mm-hmm. which I will say I totally believe, because I don't know how many times I've dropped I've got an iPhone 13 Pro, and those things are crazy heavy. So the bigger they are, the harder they fall. But man, my screen is totally intact, and I have yet to have to start snooping around and seeing how much a replacement screen is going to cost to DIY it. But I've equated repairing your own electronics to changing your own oil in your car. That's not something that people do anymore. but do anymore for multiple reasons. I don't know. People don't want to mess with their car. Cars are more computers than anything else these days. Yeah. But at least with a phone, you don't have to deal with old oil and trying to figure out like how to dispose of it, and it's just a big mess. But the ability to be a little bit handy when it comes to some of the things that you have on hand that are in your possession that you have been tasked with maintaining, I think it can go a long way in not only saving money, but also it's like you feel good about it. You kind of fiddle with it and you're like, yes, I am a dude or a chick who just repaired their own phone. It is back to working. There's like a sense of accomplishment
from
a psychological standpoint.
No, I totally get that. And so, yeah, I would look at some of those YouTube videos. I would follow some of the advice from folks on the Facebook group who have had similar issues with their charging ports. See if it works. Try to prolong the life of this phone if you can. And if not, if the port, you know, can't be cleaned out and it's just time for a new phone, we'll give our favorite options, although I will say the options are slim. Yeah. The Pixel A series is one of the options I would typically recommend. You've got one, and it doesn't sound like it's working out so hot. Sorry about that. But I've had multiple different versions of the Pixel A series, and maybe it's just time to upgrade to a slightly newer version of that A series. I really did. I think I did. The last one I had was the 6A, and I really enjoyed it. Yeah. Like, I thought it was a really good phone, and it's amazing.
Until it didn't last you for even 2 years, though, right? Yeah. Like, I mean, so it's funny that we were talking about frugal versus cheap, and you have to kind of start weighing what you want to prioritize, because on one hand, it's like, man, here is an affordable option, and for a lot of people, I think that is the option for them to consider.
Yeah.
But then you start thinking, how often am I sending this to the landfill?
Yeah.
It comes down to being
if you spend twice as much, but you keep it,
a responsible or a responsible consumer.
Yeah. So. And if you spend twice as much, but you keep it two times longer than,
or even more, or even longer. Yeah.
Then thinking about it on how much you're spending on a per year basis, I think is a good way to think about
exactly.
it. And so, yeah, if I'm buying $1,000 phone, then I want it to last for 3 or hopefully 4 years. Think about it like that. Like, maybe the more expensive option is going to, you're going to get more juice out of it. Another option, right, since you're already used to using Android phones, is going with something from the company OnePlus. You can get their base model for just a hair over $250. I hear people sing the praises of OnePlus, and so it seems like they make really good phones. They're not like Samsung.
Those are the ones that you can like swap out the battery and...
I think so. I think,
like they're made to be repaired, I think.
No, that's a different... Okay. You're thinking of the Free Phone or something like that.
Oh.
Which we've had listeners write about before. Which
those are in Europe.
They're Europe, yeah.
For the most part.
No, OnePlus is, I believe, an American company, and they sell pretty solid Android phones that people really like.
Nice.
And if you love Apple, the iPhone SE, that's a solid phone at a pretty solid price.
Yeah.
I think Kate's still got, what, the second gen?
I got her a new one.
Oh, did you?
For Christmas.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Look at that.
I got her the same kind that I got.
Big spender.
Which, well, here's the thing. You would say that because you're like, oh my gosh, you got her a 13 Pro. So I got her the exact same phone that I got. But that means that thing was announced like 3 or 4 years ago. Like, literally, I'm on my third year with that phone, and I didn't even buy it new. It was after they had announced, well, I don't know. Basically, when they're coming out with 15s and you reach back into the past and you buy a Pro,
yeah.
I mean, she was happy because she got a new phone, and I don't know if that's something she would have pulled the trigger on, but she also kind of like looked at, like side-eyed me a little bit. She's like, wait, which ones did they just announce? This is, I think, the biggest
But the SE was a good phone for a long time.
The SEs are great, and there's a third gen Apple SE as well, but just buy the ones that are a couple years old, because the technology has not improved all that much.
No.
They're getting better incrementally, as opposed to the first, I don't know, 10 years that the iPhone was out, where there are just massive jumps from one model to the next.
And Apple in particular is really good about maintaining security updates for those phones for years and years and years. So you get the 13, you've still probably got 5 years worth of Apple covering that model.
Exactly. Yeah. So I don't know. In my mind, that's the way to go, is just keeping that device around. And you know what? Again, like, I got that phone sometime in 2021. And I promise you, like, it feels just as fresh and capable as ever.
Yeah.
And, you know, put a case on it, put a screen protector on there, and realize too that we just do more with our phones. Like, there is a whole lot more utility that we derive from those devices. You know, like a flip phone.
It's back my when favorite we're flashlight.
Like,
you
back,
know?
Back when it is back when we're teenagers, and you compare that to the prices on other technology devices that we've seen plummet. Like, just think about flat screens.
Yeah.
Right. Like, we've seen TVs get bigger and nicer, and the prices plummet. And so you think, why the heck are phones so expensive? Well, I guarantee you probably
they
watch
so
just
much
as much TV, quote unquote TV, on your phone as you do on your actual flat screen at home.
And the innards have only gotten better, more robust. I mean,
they're so stinking fast, man. Yeah,
exactly. It's hard to see because you're like, the screen size is the same, and so is the storage amount. But some of those other things that you're not actually able to look at with your own two eyes that are happening underneath the titanium or whatever it is that they're making the phones out of.
It's so silly.
It's impressive. Yeah. And I guess, okay, one other thing I want to mention just from a ridiculously cheap standpoint is Motorola phones. Motorola makes some solid phones in the $150 to $250 range. They come with more trade-offs, and it might be like a stepping stone phone that's not you're not using for 3 to 4 years.
But it can bridge you to the point to where maybe you feel a little bit better about the device you're using.
And don't forget to think about buying used, buying refurbished. Maybe a friend is upgrading their phone. They're looking to get rid of it. And you're like, oh, you got the iPhone 13 Pro? You're going for the 15? Sucker. All right, I'll take, how much can I buy yours for?
Absolutely.
That's a great way to save money on a phone, too, is kind of going with the hand-me-down model.
Yeah, it's just about as good, and you're paying a whole lot less for it. But, Matthew, we hope that gets you pointed in the right direction. Joel, our beer that you and I enjoyed during this episode is This Is the Day. What were your thoughts on this Tarte Saison?
I love a good Tarte Saison. I will say, the tart combined with the funky is my favorite, and I wish this had a little more funk going on, but I still really dug it. It had actually some interesting hop notes, too, going on at the same time, which Saisons are not usually known for. So this
almost, it's like tart and dry as well. It kind of drink like a table beer. Light ABV, not a whole lot of flavor, which means it's just nice to just have it tableside here while we talk about money, and it's a nice sipper. Also means we could have been eating some steak or something with it, and it would not have overpowered the meal as well. This is another
one. You should have brought the ribeye in, bro.
This was another beer by Piedmont Brewery. Be sure to check them out if you happen to be driving through Macon, Georgia. But, buddy, that's going to be it for this episode. We'll make sure to link to either previous episodes that we mentioned, some of the different articles that we mentioned during this episode, up in our show notes at howtomoney.com.
Yeah, like that one from Nick Majuli. It's nerdy if you want to know more.
Learn all about leveraged ETFs.
Yeah, if you want to know more about the risks of too much leverage, that's a good article.
But the TLDR is just don't do it.
Yeah.
Just don't buy leveraged ETFs. You can read the article if you want.
But like Nick says, like his book is titled, Just Keep Buying in general. So that's our encouragement to you as well. Keep buying assets. Keep investing your money. But maybe just not in the leveraged ETFs. All right, that's going to do it, Matt. Until next time. Best friends out.
Best friends out.
All right. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.